shortly after that, I started backing my father up. He suddenly started playing country fiddle. So I got hold of a flat pick, and I started doing a kind of Carter family style.
Your father went from classical music to country fiddle?
Yeah, it was a very very sudden switch. Up until that point, he had been really into his classical music, and he practiced a lot, and it was very beautiful. That was my background. Mm-hmm. And then one day he came home, and he said, "Listen to this." And it's like screech, screech, you know. That whole thing, and it was wonderful. It was a whole new thing, and it was kind of almost like sacrilegious. Like, this is a whole new, new kind of.
Where did your father get a fiddle from?
Well, a fiddle is the same thing as a violin. What do you mean? Where did he?
And where did he pick up? Yeah, the country influence.
Probably just somewhere in the city. I mean, at that time in the village, the city was filled with musicians coming and going. And
this was about what year? What are you talking about?
Oh. Probably 1961.
So you're a child of Greenwich Village.
Yes. Is that bad?
No, I think that's great. I mean, you've probably been at those old small folk clubs.
Yeah.
You see Jimi Hendrix and he was performing there?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You like to name drop?
I always tended not to all my life. I really did know a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
But I always thought that it was unnecessary to ever mention their names or talk about them because they just came and went like... friends, like people.
Yeah, well, being in that area was just normal.
Yeah, I mean, well, do you want me to drop some names just for fun?
Well, go ahead. Go.
Okay, well, for instance, people like Bob Dylan would come in and was a friend of my father's, and I remember Bob Dylan coming in when he looked exactly like the first album cover that you have at your house, with a little hat and sort of this sort of rounder cheeks and all. He used to come in and play guitar and talk to my father. And Joan Baez came in, and I mean, we made sandals for just about everybody. I made a saxophone strap for Sonny Rollins. Tim Hardin came in.
You made sandals for Joan Baez?
Probably. I'm trying to remember. I know that, all the people that went off to become bluegrass musicians definitely used to
come in. Well, at this time, in the early 60s, it wasn't, the folk thing didn't catch on. And so that must have been some transformation there when all of a sudden it was the craze.
Well, it caught on at about that time. Well, you know, there was the days of the Weavers and Pete Seeger. If I knew more about it, I could say more about who started it and how they started it. But probably, you know, Woody Guthrie and then Pete Seeger. And all I know is that I was aware of it from the time I was about 11, and it was really a very important and major music scene at that time in the village.
So you were always playing music. When did you first perform? When did you first get on stage and play?
Probably when I was about 12, and it was with my father backing him up, and I felt totally confident and happy, and I later had to deal with that feeling, but at that time, just being a child raised with it, it was natural as ever, mm-hmm. and I just felt like that I belonged there, and I had no thoughts of fear or anything.
You have three albums right now released on Rounder. A fourth mm-hmm. one is coming up in a little while. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I guess the first Rounder album was about 4 or 5 years ago, mm-hmm. but your recording history goes way back before that.
Right.
And I guess your first recording is with what was your first recording?
The first recording that I ever did, if we really want to get primeval and go back to prehistoric days, is an album that I made live for my father for Christmas, my sister and I. My sister actually plays music too, but she hasn't really gone with that in her life. She does other things.
A family album.
Right. Well, the two of us, my mother took us to a studio when I was 11 years old.
Okay.
And we were playing, at that time, like folk music, some nice old English ballads and stuff like that, and some classical music. And I just remember that we had one shot to do it. It was going live onto the disc. And they still do that for high-quality recordings. I've heard that there are studios that do that. And we played our little recorder songs, and we sang, and we played our little guitar songs, and we made mistakes, and they went right on the record. And it was, that was it. That was my first record, and I still have it to this day. And I painted a little cover for it and gave it to my dad for Christmas. Then when I was 12, we played on an album called, I think it's called the Elektra String Band Project. It was on Elektra Records, and it was a bunch of different people who all came together, a guy named Billy Vanover, just a lot of people, Peter, oh, I'm going to get all these names wrong, good people who have gone on to become important in all aspects of the music uh-huh. business, and they were all getting together and playing like bluegrass, old-time music, and I was on that on two cuts, and I got paid, and that was the beginning of my professional career at age 12.
Okay, so what took so long to get a Rounder contract?
Okay, well, that's a gigantic, lengthy answer to that question. If you really want to know,
let me try to make it really short. Okay, let me just
first
explain that Rounder Records is one of the larger independent record companies that distributing folk and acoustic music and blues and bluegrass, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And to sign a contract with them would not necessarily mean success, but it means they're going to work for you. They're going to help send out your album and promote
you. It's a good label. I could have done music. When I was 16, I recorded this album called How to Play Blues Guitar with Stephan Grossman. It came out as an instructional album. It's still available today, but not on Elektra anymore, on Stephan Grossman's own label, Kicking Mule Records. From the time that I was 14, when I started playing blues, when I met Stephan Grossman and he introduced me to blues, he introduced me to a lot of the old blues players, Reverend Gary Davis, Skip James, Son House, who was Robert Johnson's teacher, Booker White, Fred McDowell, Mississippi John Hurt, and we traveled around together and we met the blues people and we just had an incredible time. From the time I was 14 to 16, I played solidly all the time, constantly, and did a lot of transcribing and figuring out of the old songs.
Mm-hmm.
And after the album, How to Play Blues Guitar, I stopped playing for a long time, maybe 8, maybe 10 years, and did other things, and did actually a lot of artwork. I still am an artist
mm-hmm.
whenever I have time to be. And then when I started up again, I started writing music, as I think I told you on the television interview that I had been sort of told that you can't make it with blues, it's not commercial, so you have to write music.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote music, and I wrote music, and I did that for a while, and I finally came across a Rounder record sort of accidentally, and they suggested I make a blues album. So it was their suggestion.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, I was actually looking for a record contract at that time for my R&B stuff. So they said, well, that's too commercial for us. We don't know how to promote the commercial stuff, but why don't you do a blues album?
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as carrying on a tradition?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. In fact, my original feelings about it were that it was such a private tradition. It was something that you had to apprentice yourself to and almost suffer for and, you know, figure it out, and only people who wanted to sit and do that and figure it out should be playing it, and only people who've learned directly, you know, which I now think is wrong. But at that time, I felt like it was almost like a sacred thing and you had to be initiated into the rites of it somehow. And now I feel totally differently. Now I feel like if you don't show it to other people and you don't share it and you don't teach it to other people, it's not going to carry, the tradition of it will not be able to be carried on. And I now feel totally involved in the desire to spread the information, which I see is more than possible. Mm-hmm. And there are receptive people out there who are interested. But just to carry it on, to carry the tradition on, to keep it alive, I really feel involved with that now.
Well, how would you describe traditional blues, the type that you're promoting, the type that you're carrying on?
It's a very soulful kind of music. It was written by people who needed to express themselves through their music. It's something that was a very individual form of music. Each song is very different from the next. There was no feeling that it has to be written this way, the chords must sound like this, the tunings are like this. It was invented by, I really think of it as something that was invented again and again by each writer in a different way. And as a result, it's a very varied, widely varied music and melodies and chords and tunings that make up country blues. It's just the most important thing about it is it's very soulful, and it expresses very deep emotions, whether love or anger or sorrow or whatever. But it's a very deep music.
Play something.
Play something. Oh, I thought you'd never ask. is Mississippi Blues, and this song I originally heard on a tape played on piano, and I transcribed it from piano, which was that was my greatest love, was transcribing things, figuring out how to voice them on the guitar when they were maybe even on another instrument, or figuring out what tuning they were in, that kind of thing. So this was on the piano. It was written by Willie Brown. Delta, you know I can and have my fun. I said I got to have my fun, baby. Lord, I'm going back to the Delta. You know I can have my fun. Where I can drink my white light and gamble. Where I can bring my baby home. Love, don't the Delta look lonesome when I said at evening sun go down. Love, don't the Delta look lonesome when I said at evening sun go down. Where you been looking for your baby? Don't know where he could be found. Lonely, he treat me dirty, boy. Don't you know I love him just the same? He treat me dirty, boy. I said I love him just the same. You know it just breaks my heart to hear some other gal call his name.
Now, who wrote that song?
Willie Brown.
Willie Brown.
Yep. There were two different Willie Browns that wrote country blues. And one wrote Future Blues and M&O Blues, and the other wrote Mississippi Blues, and obviously other songs, too. But those are the only that I am aware of that those two different, by the same name, have written, and I do all those three songs.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to get a little bit to your the homespun tape that you did. That's a tape where people who want to learn, I guess, your style of blues, they can send away this cassette,
right,
and you teach them over.
And I still haven't found out the address.
You don't know the address?
Yesterday I was making a plug on this, and I didn't remember the address either. I think it's like Post Office Box 498. I'll be pretty amazed if it isn't Woodstock, New York.
Woodstock.
It's I've done a tape lesson series for
homespun
tapes.
How long ago did you do that? How long ago?
That's very recent. That's about 6 months ago that it came out. And Artie Traum, whose brother owns the company, Happy Traum own, and Jane Traum own Homespun Tapes. And Artie is an old friend of mine, and he was sort of there as I was recording it and telling me sort of the way it's normally done, and I sort of got into the groove of it and then had a great time. It's six different tapes, or is it more than that? No, I think it's six tapes, two songs, that's what it is, 12 songs altogether, two songs on the average, two or more songs per tape. And it sort of starts from the beginning of how I play guitar, and everything that I know about blues is on those tapes. Everything that I can possibly explain, I'm not holding back any secrets. I explain everything I know about how to, you know, bang and snap and dampen the strings and you name it. I've discussed it all to the best of my ability, and my favorite songs are there. I didn't save any for myself.
Okay, so that's
yeah. That's, so it's Homespun Tapes. Probably box 498. I'm pretty sure about that.
Woodstock,
New York.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the zip code.
Okay, and you also have a you have three albums on Rounder, as I stated before. Your first one, Blue Horizon.
First one is High Heel Blues.
High Heel Blues.
Then Blue Horizon.
Then Steel String and
Rhinestones and Steel String. Yes.
And you have a new one coming out, I guess, early next year.
Right.
Called
I've Got a Rock in My Sock.
I Got a Rock in My Sock.
Yeah, it's a song that I wrote. I generally have something funny on each record. I don't know how familiar you are with Rhinestones and Steel Strings, but there's a song called Doctor Make It Right. And it's kind of bawdy, and it's kind of funny. And this I've Got a Rock in My Sock is similar in its, you know, humorous
sounds
aspect.
Like a, sounds like a great intro.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the title of the album. It's got a very funny cover, too. We really had fun doing setting up a hysterical cover. So.
And I want to, again, I've talked with you yesterday. We had an interview for cable TV. And for those who live in Dade County, there's a TV show called Folk Exposure on Educational Channel 2 every Tuesday and Thursday night at 9:05. So that's you're going to be on, I guess, the week after next. But you mentioned that there are some great artists you found to play with you on that album.
I light up like a torch when you mention this because I'm so happy about it. The first good luck was getting Taj Mahal on the album.
Uh-huh.
And each one of my albums for Rounder have had somebody wonderful or two or three wonderful people on them, starting with John Sebastian on High Heel Blues and others that I'm not mentioning or forgetting about, but they're there and they're wonderful. And then Blue Horizon had Larry Hoppin from the Orleans Band and others that I'm forgetting and not, you know, that deserve to be mentioned. And then Blue Rhinestones had the Persuasions.
Mm-hmm.
And now this one, I first had the good luck of having Taj Mahal come and then also David Bromberg, and we've known each other for years and we go way back to the Village, the days that we were talking about before. And then Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder is not really a blues singer. He's not known for his blues.
No, he's known for R&B. However, they're so closely related, I think it's pretty hard to take them apart.
Is this album, do you go off on, you don't stick with blues on this album? Is it more?
Well, it has more original material than any of the previous three, and that's not because I didn't have original material to put on the other three. It's just that I wanted to have traditional blues songs on there, so I chose the traditional songs that I had known for years and did them, but this one I wanted specifically, as a matter of fact, Rounder Records suggested that I branch out a little bit. You know, I said, well, I can make you another High Heel Blues album any day. I can put like all traditional and a couple original written in that idiom. And they said, no, why don't you do something different? So it's about half blues and over half original. And there are a couple of really spunky, different type, you know, a little bit of jazz. The Got a Rock in My Sock is jazzy and funny. And then the song with Stevie Wonder is a ballad. I'm just so happy with it that I can't possibly tell you. And then one with his backup singers. He's got three marvelous backup singers that work with him. And they sang a song that is absolutely Motown sounding. I mean, it just sounds like a Motown hit record. And I'm really happy about that. But it's very lightly produced, just drums, bass, electric guitar, and the singers. And so nice sounding.
Do you have a song that you think is going to be a hit from that album?
That's the one that I told you about. Yeah, either that or it's called Send the Man Back Home, and it's a great subject too. I won't give too much away. No, I can't do it on guitar. It was literally written on as an a cappella song. I thought I was going to do it as a cappella. And then when we came into the studio, we said, well, let's put a little of this, let's put a little, and it just came out perfectly.
Oh, great.
So, but I there are some things which I write which are not, if they're not written on guitar, I never end up putting them on guitar. I don't know what shortcoming that may be, but if it's written somewhere else, it doesn't end up on the guitar.
Well, play something on the guitar.
Let me see.
Is this a song that you wrote?
Would you like me to do one that I've written? Is that what you would like me to do?
Yeah.
Okay, let me see, then I sort of have to think for a moment.
Last time I saw Stevie Wonder, he was with Michael Jackson. Did you meet Michael Jackson?
No, I didn't, but we used the Jackson's guitar player on that song, Send a Man Back Home. It's so good. I'm going to keep raving. Do I have to do an original one?
No, okay, do what you like. Do what you like.
I want to do Walking Blues by Robert Johnson. You know, they'll be, the songs that I've written are just a little bit different than traditional blues. I think that's why I go blank, because when I perform, I normally do traditional blues, by and large. And the things that I've written, I could sing God's Gift to Women.
That's a cappella, though.
The things that I've written are always like a touch different. They usually have like a slightly different instrumentation, maybe a piano or something, and on song.
Do you, obviously you spend a lot of time tuning up.
Yeah, I have to, because of each song is just about in a different tuning. And to avoid the boredom of doing all songs in a row that are all in open G and they have a similar feel to them, I move around a lot. And I'll try to remedy that someday by carrying a couple of different instruments and having them set up in the different tunings. But even so, you know, every time you take a capo off, every time you put it on, every different room, every time you play, it goes in and out. So it's always going to be a consideration, is tuning. It's always like while I'm in the middle of a song and I realize I'm badly out of tune, there's always a consideration period, like shall I stop, shall I tune? Should I put up with it? You know, there's always that going on in my mind.
What's your rule of thumb?
That if it's really bad, I just stop. And people like that. They really do. And I tell them I'm going to take up where I left off and just start writing. You know, it's no big deal. I just tune it and start again. Got up this morning, said I. Feel around for my shoes. You know about it, got them on. Walking blues now, up this morning side. Whoa, I feel around for my shoes. I said, you know about it, got them on. Whoa, oh, walking blues. Well, I've been to skirt side, gone ride the blind. Babe, I've been mistreated and I don't mind dying now. Up this morning side, whoa, I'm gonna ride a blind. I said, you know, babe, I've been mistreated and I, whoa, said I don't mind dying. Well, some people tell you that those worried blues ain't bad. It's a worse old feeling I'm on ever had now. Some people tell you that don't hold worry, hold blues ain't bad. I said, it's a worse old feeling now, baby, I'm on ever had.
Mentioned earlier that well, you live in Greenwich Village. You've met Reverend Gary Davis. You must have got many, many pointers here and there. Is there any one that really stand out in your mind?
You know, it's really odd that I haven't had as many pointers as I have just simply imitated and learned from watching and seeing. You know, I was rather quiet because I felt like if I were in the presence of someone like Mississippi John Hurt when I was 16 years old, I didn't as much say, gee, could you show me that, as much as watch. And you know, there were some nice compliments that I would get just by someone saying, you know, geez, you know, where did she learn to play blues? How you know, how did you teach her? Or everyone assumed that Stephan Grossman taught me how to play. And they would say, how did you show her how to do that? And he would say, well, I don't know. She refuses to show me. I'm trying to learn from her. But I didn't so much get pointers, really. The only thing that I did have said to me once, which is kind of funny, is that the song Future Blues, which has this snapping style in the bass where you reach your thumb right under and you just about rip the string. You go like that. That's a Mississippi style, that particular style. And I played that for Reverend Gary Davis, and he said to Stephan, or he said to me, I don't remember, he said, no, he said, don't do that. He said, you're not supposed to snap the string like that. And I said, no, that's the way the song goes. And he said, no, that's not right. And I was trying to explain that that's the way Willie Brown did it. So that was the only pointer that stands out in my mind. But mostly I just watched and took on as much as I possibly could.
Do you still watch? Do you still go see other blues artists perform?
You know, I don't think, you know, unfortunately, that I have as much time to do that as I would like to. I'm touring so much. Mm-hmm. But when I really do get an opportunity is when I'm opening for somebody wonderful like John Lee Hooker, Willie Dixon, although he doesn't play guitar. He just stands up and is fantastic, you know. Okay. But I'm always learning. You know, I'm always learning. I'm always listening to other singers, other players, and always feeling like it's my responsibility to do the best that I can and incorporate everything.
Uh-huh.
So.
Oh, okay.
That's a fact, and that's a heck of a thing.
I would like to hear God's Gift to Women. You mind singing it?
Okay. No, I don't mind at all. You'll have to help me here by clapping. Okay, this is a song that I wrote. It's a humorous song. Remember I mentioned I always have some sort of humorous song on each album. And I felt a little worried about it because I thought, you know, maybe men would take it personally because it's sort of a song saying that you should never go out with a handsome man because they're always going to mistreat you and, you know, this kind of thing. And I meant it humorously, but I felt worried, like, well, would everybody take it humorously? So I sort of felt a little shy about it, but everyone who heard it said, no one's going to take it personally. It's funny, it's good, why don't you sing it? And John Sebastian loved it, and we thought of putting it on one of the albums, but we didn't know why. It just didn't happen at that time. And Rounder Records heard it, and they loved it. You know, they kept saying, why don't you record it? And I felt like, well, I might offend somebody, you know. And other people said, no, you won't offend people, just play it. So Rounder suggested that I sing it with the Persuasions. And here are like five great-looking guys coming in to back me up. And I felt encouraged. I said, well, if they don't mind, you know, then I've got their support, you know. And it's just plain a good feeling. It's a fun feeling. And it goes like this. And you can clap on the offbeat. I'll show you where I want you to clap. You can clap out there in the live audience, too. You know, that'll help. We'll hear you. Just clap really loudly. I don't want no handsome man, no, because he won't treat me right. Lord, always flirting and cheating and staying out half the night. Lord, everybody wants it, love, but that don't mean it's good. I said I'd rather have a plain-looking man who loves me like he should. I said God's gift to women, that's what they think they are. Lord, God's gift to women, just like a movie star. Hey, everybody wants him, but that don't mean it's good. I said I'd rather have a plain-looking man who loves me like he should. You know, a plain man lacks his loving, but a handsome man makes you beg. He wants to see you crawling, kneeling by his leg. Oh! I said he always keeps you waiting, because he don't have much to give, no. I said he thinks you should be grateful for having him to dig. In the studio audience, sing, God's gift to win, and out there in Radio Land. That's what we hear you. That God's gift to women, just like a movie star. Hey, everybody wants it, love, but that don't mean it's good. Said I'd rather have a plain-looking man who loves me like he should. You know, a plain man will be faithful. He's into being true. He don't need no fancy car. He just wants to make love to you. Woo! He won't win no beauty contest, though, but that's just not what counts. You need lots of tender loving by the pound and not the ounce. Everybody, I said, God's gift to women. Woo! That's what they think they're. Lord God, give to women just like a movie star. Hey, everybody wants him, Lord, but that don't mean it's good. I said I'd rather have a plain-looking man who loves me like he should. Ooh, I'd rather have a plain-looking man who loves me like he should. Oh!
Yeah. Yep. That's fun.
Rory Block is live in our studio. Real men wouldn't get offended by that.
Yeah. We had so much fun yesterday, Michael and James and I, we were all saying real men this and real... What is that from, Saturday Night Live?
I don't know.
Real men don't eat quiche probably started.
That's probably
it's fun. Yeah, we were joking around.
So now you only hang out with real men, right?
Well, you know, I think one of these days, it always gets a lot of response, that song, because, you know, sometimes you see people getting a little uncomfortable, like maybe thinking, well, maybe I'm kind of good looking. I've always felt good about it until this moment. And as he's pointing out something potentially bad about me, like, what am I going to do? But hopefully everybody would take it well.
That's strange.
Yeah.
Well, that's fun. Do you enjoy performing?
Oh, no, I hate it. Just kidding. No, of course, I have to say yes.
Do you mind traveling and being on the road? And
Yes, it's definitely. I think that it's definitely. It's a marvelous way to make yourself known. It's a marvelous way to get out and see people and expand on your career. It's not always, you know, sometimes you, like anybody else in any other career, sometimes you'd just rather go to bed than go out to work. However, you know, and you mix that in with all the times when you're feeling in a great mood and you do want to go on stage. There are just times when, you know, you're tired, and like anybody else, you know, there's the Monday morning blues and you don't want to get up and go to the office. It's, you know, the stage is my office, and so I am entitled to once in a while feel like, wish I were, you know, lying in the sun doing nothing. But, you know, by and large, it's something I love very much and couldn't live without. I can say that for sure. I couldn't live without it, and I'd much rather be doing it than not. So for the few times that I feel so sorry for myself because I have to work like 5 nights in a row, it definitely is outweighed by the joy of doing it.
What aspect of the business do you enjoy the most then? From the recording to the touring to whatever?
I would say offhand that up until now I've liked recording the most because I'm really excited and sort of overjoyed in the studio. I love the studio, what happens in the studio. But it's a close runner, you know, a close runner up is performing live and having a good show. I think that's about equal to the same excitement level, and it's equally nourishing for you and the people listening. So I love them both.
It's just strange the fact that you could go anywhere in the country virtually and attract an audience. Are you amazed by any of that?
Yeah, I am actually. But like I said, in the last year, maybe I didn't say this, but the last year everything's been going really well, and better than it had been up until, you know, the High Heel Blues really started things doing well, and especially in the last year, I've noticed that, to my own amazement, you know, because you're only your own self and you don't know how people view you necessarily, and to see the large number of enthusiastic people who are responding warmly and openly it's surprising. It feels great, but it's also surprising. You think to yourself once in a while, like, well, maybe they're really wrong, you know, and then you think, no, you know, I believe in myself, but it's still a surprise to see other people being moved by what you do. That's very wonderful. Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Can you play another song?
Well, I don't know. Let me see. If anybody here would like to ask me anything, I think that would be fine, too. I mean, I think that would make it really nice and relaxed. People ask me about tunings. You know, sometimes in audiences, people will say, well, what tuning is that song? Or, you know, and I love that kind of thing. I love to explain things like that to people.
It seems almost, I mean, this, I don't, I'm not that familiar with tunings of guitars, but it's, is that a, that's like a trick, isn't it? Would you consider it not, cheating, and almost a
what?
Way of cheating?
What?
Or tuning your guitar strings differently all the time? Or?
Oh, gosh, no, it's exactly the opposite of that. How could it possibly be viewed as, anything, it's making life much harder for yourself.
Yeah.
The concept of it being cheating would mean it's making it easier.
Uh-huh.
Right? Do we agree on that? That the cheating is making something easier, doing it the easy way,
right, okay.
And finding a funny shortcut. First of all, the amount of time and energy involved in tuning is in itself making it more difficult. I would say it's going out of your way to make it more beautiful. That's what tuning is. If you didn't tune, you'd do everything in the same tuning, and the voicing would be limited, the sound would be limited. It would be so limiting and boring. Tunings are providing great variety.
How many different tunings do you use?
Well, see, I use, most commonly, I use regular tuning, which is just the guitar in its regular state. Then I use drop D tuning, which is the lower E string tuned down to match the D string, and then played with a D chord. So that's the second tuning, a drop D tuning. It's called an open D. I use that on a lot of tunes. Open G. And beyond that, other tunings are a little bit more out there, like there's an open C tuning. That's right. Occasionally I'll use it for a ragtime song.
On the side of your guitar, you have all your songs written down.
Yeah, those are my little cheaty.
That's cheating.
Now that's cheating. Okay, we'll get that right out front. Yeah, I used to say, I tell a little story about how when I was in school, I discovered, this is sort of like some poetic license involved here, but I discovered that, this is my little Murphy's Law theory here, that if you try to cheat and you do something behind people's backs, they always find you out. You know, there's no way to, like, eat out the inside of the cake that you find in the icebox, close up the icing, and have no one later on discover that you did that. I know someone who did that when they were a kid. They ate the whole inside out, closed it back up, sealed the icing, and assumed that no one would ever figure out that he had eaten the cake. So, I have discovered that, you know, if you sneak around like that, people always find out everything you do and say, invariably. And if you do things right out front, 9 times out of 10, people don't notice. So I had this little game that I played where I wrote the test answers right on index cards and scotch taped them right on top of my desk. And I wrote on top of the card, Cheeto card. And no one said a word, you know. And so I sort of was cementing this theory at a very early age. Let's see, what am I doing? Open D tuning.
Now, on your cheat sheet on the side of your guitar, do you have the tunings that you use for each song?
No, at least I've memorized that. Okay. You know, there's some things that I don't need to cheat about. So these are my little set lists. For a while, when I first started touring heavily, I needed like 3 different sets because I was working 3 sets every night. And it's hard to remember, you know. Oh, geez, let's see, 15
okay.
songs in a row, three sets, all different 15 songs. That's hard to memorize. So what I first learned was the first set. You know, now I really don't have to refer to it much at all. You know, the songs just pop up in my mind. And I'll change my sets around.
Those aren't all the songs you know, though.
No, I know more than this. All I know?
No. Those are the only songs you use in performance.
Yeah. And I even at one time was, you know, really into telling stories and jokes, and I still do, and I wrote those down on the back of the guitar in a slightly more hidden location. And I don't worry about that much anymore. There are just certain stories and things that pop in my mind. But I gear my sets to where I'm playing. If I'm playing a concert, then I can do a lot of quiet songs, and I like that. I like to put in like a cappella numbers, ballads, sweet, slow songs. And when I'm playing in a noisier venue or just, you know, a louder room, I will usually just go for the hard-driving songs, the up-tempo songs, and, you know, so I change my sets around by whatever feels best. Oh, dear, now I have to move the capo down. You know, a jazz player, for instance, would probably not use a capo ever. There are certain players, purists, who play absolutely everything without a capo, but the original songs being written in those tunings, you keep the flavor of the song more if you capo, so you can sing it and keep it in that tuning. What is a capo?
Oh,
Someone is saying, we have a very involved engineer behind the glass in the other room. Not only is he singing and clapping with God's gift to women and pointing at other people. No, just kidding. But he's asking, he's saying, what is a capo? And I'm assuming everyone knows what a capo is.
I thought
he was
saying, keep
up
the tempo.
I was getting more and more anxious, like, what does he mean? I saw you having your anxiety attack there, and while I was trying to, fill up dead airspace here, not go into dead airspace. A capo is this, the end of the guitar, the bottom or the top, I don't know really honestly what it's called, where the strings come to the pegs, there's a little piece of ivory or plastic, depending on the kind of guitar you have. And that is the beginning. I'll call that the beginning, the nut. Okay, thank goodness we have other musicians here who are more informed than I am. And what's this, the saddle over here? Okay, the saddle pin. Oh, wow, he's probably a builder. All right, the nut is the beginning of the strings, and The relationship of the frets to that nut is all important when you're playing chords. Now, if you put a false, it's almost like a false nut. You can start the strings anywhere you want up the neck. If you put a little instrument that clamps down and begins the strings higher up the neck, along any fret, and then you can play the same thing as if your neck was a shorter neck, and it raises the key. So that's what a capo is, and there are all manner of capos in different shapes, and I finally found one that works for me, so I don't think I could live without it. Yes, question. Fishing blues? You mean I'm Going Fishing, the one Taj Mahal plays?
The question was, the question was, wanted to know if there's any variations of fishing blues. And do you know versions of fishing blues?
I guess I was wondering if that, trying to identify if that was the same one. I don't play that song, no. It's a lot like Freight Train, but, in its structure, but no, I don't play that song. That's the first song I ever fingerpicked. I could try that. I was just about to play, and I've made this big, huge thing of tuning into open D. So I was just about to play That's No Way For Me To Get Along.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
And I often say when I play this song that this was also recorded by the Rolling Stones, and they called it The Prodigal Son. And the only thing that still remains the same as the original with their version is the part that goes, and that's no way for me to get along. People recognize that part, but the rest of the song is different. And it was originally written by Reverend Robert Wilkins. I'm going home, have sat down, have told my ma, look to my pa, said and sit down, tell my pa, hey, Nelson, going home. Down and tell the boss, Lord, I'm going home. Sit down and tell the boss that that's no way for me to get along. Those low down men, daddy, they treated your poor girl wrong. But they treated your poor girl wrong. Hey, now, sit low down, man, that treated your poor girl wrong. Say the low down man that treated you cool, get wrong. And that's no way for me to get along. They treated me like my poor heart was made of a rock of stone. That is made of a rock of stone. Hey, now treat me like my poor heart was made of a rock of stone. Treat me like my poor heart was made of a rock. She didn't go, Daddy, where she didn't go. Hey, now was nothing to go, Daddy, where she didn't go. Was nothing to go, Daddy, where she didn't go. And that's no way for me to get
Blocks live in the studio of WLRN. Where do you find your old blues songs?
They're a little bit hard to find, but when I was 14, and as I mentioned, I had met Stephen Grossman at that time. He had been friends with a bunch of people who collected the old albums, the rare, hard to find recordings, reissues and originals. And as a result, I was able to have access to records and tapes that are very, very hard to find. There are now a number of labels who are reissuing old ones, and so they're a little bit less hard to find. You can find them on Yazoo Records, and that's out of New York City. Mm-hmm. That's 245 Waverly Place, New York 10014.
That's good.
Registered that one in my mind. I once made an album for them. That's how I know their address.
Okay.
Yazoo Records has a lot of old blues reissues and current blues artists. Also, Blue Goose Records is the same label, subsidiary. Biograph Records in Chatham, New York. Biograph Records, Chatham, New York, 12037. I know that zip code too. You're sure to get like a catalog or something. They have lots of old jazz and blues, and I'm sure there are many others. Kicking Mule probably has some.
Do you always search for new material, or if something comes along and you like it, do you to yourself, "That's a song I got to learn"?
If something comes along and I like it, yeah, I will do that. But actually, you're really touching a weak spot in me, because I don't enough look for new material. It's only when it comes time to make an album that I suddenly think, well, I want to put so many traditional songs on it, and I think, wait a second, I've used them all up. You know, I've used up the ones that I know. I need to either write more, and I always think to myself, because I have such a love for the old traditional blues, I think, like, definitely don't just try to get away with writing them. You know, go and research more of them and find out more of them. And that's how come I did That's No Way for Me to Get Along. I never played that until I wanted to record Rhinestones and Steel Strings. And it forces me to branch out, which is really good for me. And besides, I should know more.
When you say branch out, that's interesting, because you're being built as a blues performer.
Uh-huh.
And have you yet come across any purists who are upset the fact that you've done rhythm and blues, or you've gone
into other? Definitely. It's so funny that, you know, people don't want any change in you. And recently I was in North Carolina, and I had always made my reputation up till this point appearing on stage with jeans, as I appear to you right here, right now, high heels, rhinestones, and some sort of a fancy blouse. And I sort of established myself as that. And the first time I wore a dress on stage, it got written in the paper in Boston, like, uncharacteristically, Rory Block appeared with a dress to the floor, you know, what's going on? And this person in North Carolina said, I don't know if you should wear a dress on stage. I said, why? And he said, well, we're used to you in jeans, you know. And I felt like, well, yeah, okay, you don't want to accept my moving on. I've completely lost the train of thought. What did we start with?
No, I'm asking you about these purists.
Oh, the purists, right. There you have an example of certain purists. And that, I appreciate their point of view, too. And there are certainly a lot of people who have taken me to task for making a disco album. And I try to explain.
Okay.
What? They say. There are people I know right now listening to this broadcast that I told them that it was, who love my disco album. They have it. I was on Chrysalis Records, and I had made one R&B album for them, and it just got super reviews. Really was a wonderful album. And the follow-up to that album, Chrysalis Records, literally made me do a disco album. They said, R&B is out, disco's in. And that's why I'm not on Chrysalis anymore, because I objected to that strenuously, and I said, wait a minute, R&B can never go out. It's a classic style. How can you say it's outdated? And they said, well, it's, you know, what's in right now, it's trendy, it's disco, you need to make a disco album, we want you to have a hit record. And I just said, you know, I really objected. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, they had my best interest in mind, they did make me do, other than my original material, they made me do things in a certain way. And after that, we realized that our relationship had just sort of like, withered away, because
It was your attitude, obviously, that caused your disco album not to go super.
I don't know. You know, it was on the charts.
Oh,
it was on the charts, and there are still a lot of people who say to me that they have it and they love it. But get this. Okay, this is the funny thing. I was performing at a college somewhere, and someone passed a note to me in the backstage saying, I have your disco album, and I can't believe, you're not going to expect this, that you've fallen so low as to sing blues. How can you sell out like that? Someone said that.
Great.
It's usually the other way around. It's like, how can you sell out, and how could you have done this, and how could you make this commercial album? But never, how could you sell out like that and doing
blues?
I thought that was funny. But there has been only one person who said that to me. So.
Well, you saved the note.
No, I'm afraid I don't know what I did with it. I lost it. No. But I still think, you know, it's perfectly legitimate for someone to feel that way. I mean, sure. Everybody's entitled.
I would think you'd meet Stevie Wonder faster playing disco than you would playing the blues.
I wouldn't be so sure of that, really. Stevie Wonder loves Taj Mahal, you know. I mean, Stevie Wonder, I'm sure Stevie Wonder knows about all country. I'm just sure he does know, and I'm sure that he respects it. You know, I'm sure he loves it. I'm just guessing, but I would imagine. Yeah.
Can you play the Mississippi John Hurt tunes? Sure. Back, like,
maybe Candyman? I don't do Candyman, but I do Stagley and I do Frankie and Albert.
We had a request here in our studio audience for Mississippi John Hurt, and you'll play, what did you say?
Stagley.
Stagley.
Yeah. I have to tune back to regular tuning. They can listen to, the radio audience can listen to the exact process of the tuning.
Oh, while we have this time, I will mention that Rory is at Tobacco Road tonight, and 615 South Miami Avenue is the address for Tobacco Road, and I believe the show starts around 10:30 or so.
Yeah, better to get there before then, though, because you never know when it is going to start. Could be earlier.
Also, the fact that Rory has, I know, 3 albums available on Rounder Records, not counting the disco album. But Rory has 3 albums on Rounder Records, and another one due out next year with a number of special guests, Dave Bromberg, Taj Mahal, and also Stevie Wonder's on her next album.
Here we are in regular tuning. Capoed on the 2nd fret. I like to be as informative as possible when I'm playing. And in fact, I really like the image of teacher now. I really do. I've done a lot of workshops and lectures on country blues. And the most important thing that I always say to everybody, and I tell them when they're asking me what about how to play country blues on guitar, is play with a lot of gusto. Don't lay back in your playing. Don't play like polite little quiet notes. Even if you get buzzing, which I want to say that I always get buzzing. I get more buzzing than I even think I should get, but I get a lot of buzzing because I really attack the strings. And I think that has a great deal to do with making it have a good sound, is just, don't be polite, don't be shy, attack the strings. You know, really play them like you mean it. And here I go with a real polite sounding song.
When you say country blues, is that different from regular blues? What do you mean by country blues?
Yeah, country blues was a category put on a certain music that came from a certain area at a certain time. And so to that extent only, it describes what it is. It was the early rural, mostly rural, you know, country meaning from the countryside, black blues from this country, written mainly in the 20s and the 30s, and recorded around that time. I can't say it was written then. I would have to say it was mostly recorded at about that time. And so that is what the term country blues refers to. And then there's old-timey music, which is another, which was the white rural southern music that came from the South at that same time. So these are just terms, you know, country mm-hmm. blues, old-timey music, whatever, okay. loosely described.
And then there's, New Orleans blues. Is that that's different from country blues?
Well, what I know the most about is country blues, and I know that then there's urban blues, you know, like the stuff that Muddy Waters started playing and Elmore James, you know, electrified, one step more evolved, not as in terms of sophistication, but as far as the instrumentation and the electrical, you know, the adding of the electricity. So they're all offshoots. Today's rock and roll, I always rave about this, is really the roots, you know, country blues is the roots music of rock and roll. I mean, slide guitar, that's all country blues. And a lot of the stuff, like the song Get Back, JoJo, that the Beatles did, that's an old country blues riff that they used in that song. And so much of today's rock is a direct offshoot of country blues.
Mm-hmm. So with your music, you're basically keeping this part of American history alive.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you look at yourself as all as influencing the blues scene? I mean, having it evolve even further with your music?
Yeah, I think everybody's a little part of it. I don't think, you know, I have this massive influence or anything, but I feel good about the influence that I do have and the influence I see on people in the audiences. A lot of people will come up and say that they want to learn that kind of guitar. A lot of people have come up and said that they have my guitar lesson series. A lot of people will say just that they are also blues players. So I know I have some influence and some effect. How much, I don't know, but whatever it is, I'm happy for it.
Yeah. All right. I just want to first say that you're listening to Roy Black live in the studio. This is WLRN-FM, Miami-Fort Lauderdale. Tom, do you have a question?
You had mentioned before maybe some Elizabeth Cotton.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let me just... we have time for one more song, mm-hmm. and I want to thank Rory for coming down to the WLRN studio. And again, tonight at Tobacco Road, and we'll look forward to your next album, and keep in touch. Let us know what's going on.
I sure will.
Okay, and this final song you'll do is...
Freight Train. I might actually, I don't know how much I'll be able to sing this song. I'll do my best. Now, remind you that I was about 11 or 12 when I first started playing this, and it was the very first song I ever fingerpicked. And I didn't fully know the Elizabeth Cotton picking at that time. I think my dad showed me a sort of abbreviated little system. And so I don't know if I really know the verses, but I'll kind of play the song for you. Maybe even, you know, if I start, it may even be the wrong key for me, but I'm just going to launch into it anyway.
up on that.
That's a nice tune.
Rory, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And it was a pleasure meeting you. And good luck on your albums and your tour. And we'll get back to some more music right now.
Old friend, where have you been so long?